Welcome to a podcast called Intrepid. My name's Craig Forces. I'm here with Stephanie Carvin in the, once again, in the inner suburbs of Ottawa. We're not far from the Rideau River.
I like to refer to it now as our undisclosed location.
Speaking of the Rideau River, it is in fact now rising because most of the ice is gone. I noticed the other day that they had those paddles out, you know, the little boat that's got the little paddles on the other side that whacks the ice so it
yes,
breaks it up.
Those things are amazing.
Yeah, and they were out hacking away at it the other day down at my end of the city near the University of Ottawa. So today, Stephanie, we've got a packed agenda. What are we going to talk about today?
Well, we have a number of things to talk about. There's no shortage of issues that have kind of come up on the agenda recently. So I think we're going to look at four kind of hot topics, hot breaking news headlines coming forward. We're then going to look at the budget. The budget had a number of national security elements in it. And then as well, we're going to, I think, probably have a fight about whether or not the National Security Intelligence Committee of Parliamentarians is the right place to talk about some of the more controversial issues that, let's say, have been in the media.
Right. And so let's do our quick headlines then. So what's up in the world of national security headlines?
Okay, well, breaking news from, I think, last week, which is that the Peshtari case, which we've spoken about, is now suspended indefinitely. So it's not over, but it sounds like the judge...
It's pining for the fields.
Yes. The judge agreed with the defense that they needed more time to go through the kind of mountain of evidence they received because... At the 11th hour because of what we talked about last week in the podcast. So kind of some of the intelligence evidence issues, but you said there was something else going on.
Well, there were disclosure issues out of the RCMP itself. And so there's a lot of moving parts in this case, and I can't pretend to be on top of it. It's just another one of these cases that seems to be disproportionately complex, raising again the prospect of how well we can manage anti-terrorism trials. And so at some point, once the case is over, we'll have to do a diagnostic of it and figure out exactly what happened. In fact, more broadly, I'm hoping to have a little bit of money to run a larger project doing an audit of Canadian terrorism trials and trying to draw lessons from the records as they exist at present. Because one of the things about these trials is the records are all confined to courthouses around the country. And I think it's time to pull those records and run through and see if there are common themes and lessons. And this would be, I think, Exhibit A in terms of some of the complexities. But yes, the driver for the events last day really are the very late disclosure of material information, which compounds the concerns about the source in this case, who was flipped over, as you recall, from CSIS to the RCMP, and whose pedigree, whose track record is the subject there for of credibility assessments, because they're relying on what he says he saw and heard. The prosecution's relying on that for purpose of seeking a conviction. And so the credibility of this witness is front and center, which means you want to dig up as much as you can about what it is, for example, CSIS thought about this person. And that's been the fodder for a substantial amount of complication in this case.
Right. Okay. Well, stay tuned on that one. I'm sure it'll come back eventually. How it comes back, I'm not entirely sure, but there you go. So speaking of terrorism, we also have actually breaking news from today, I believe, which is that... Al Farek, who was, I believe, an American student studying in Manitoba.
Right. He was born in Texas, but he was at University of Manitoba with two other students.
Right. Who, and all three of them went to Afghanistan, Pakistan to basically train with Al Qaeda. Right. And he came back. He was caught by the Americans and has now been sentenced for his activities. And I believe that he's now been indicted and convicted of training for the purpose of conducting a terrorist attack.
Right. So he was associated with the preparation of a bomb that actually was detonated in Afghanistan in 2009. He's been sentenced to 45 years in incarceration.
Wow.
A couple lessons from this. The first is, and this is more in the domain of our colleagues to the south, Steve Vladek and Bob Chesney, who talk all the time about, is it better to go through a U.S. federal court for purposes of prosecuting terrorism, or is it better to rely on these ridiculously complicated and totally ineffectual military commissions? And the answer is, well, the U.S. federal courts are getting the job done. 45 years incarceration for this individual. Meanwhile, the military commission seems to be mired in controversy, not least recently this controversy over microphones in the defense counsel's interviews with their client.
Yeah, we're not going to go into that, but you can check out the either Lawfare blog and National Security Law podcast if you want to know more about this. But yeah, it's not not good if you find that you may be bugged while you're...
Well, the lesson is that our legal system is capable, in principle, of dealing with these issues. And as soon as you start to tinker on the margins and come up with these unique and customized bespoke systems, they tend to fall apart.
And whereas, I mean, the United States has an extremely good track record of prosecuting terrorists. So, you know, why they don't just go with that system is beyond me.
So that's the first lesson. The second, of course, aspect that concerns us in Canada is there was a Canadian nexus to this case. He was studying at the University of Winnipeg at the time he went overseas with his two colleagues. And those two colleagues, if you look on the RCMP website, you'll find that they're still wanted. Posters for these two individuals. Their whereabouts unknown. They may actually be dead, but there are these two outstanding prospects. Both of them are wanted for criminal anti-terrorism purposes in Canada, and one of them has also been indicted in the United States. So if they do wash ashore anywhere in the future, it seems likely that they too will be subjected to prosecutions.
Right, and I think this is the other thing that we often forget is, you know, travel for extremist purposes happened well before the Islamic State.
Yeah, so this is a precursor.
Yeah, it's a precursor.
Some of the things we saw with ISIS.
Yeah, and I mean, here's the thing. It's like, I think there was a recent study by Bruce Hoffman that he put out last week with the Council of Foreign Relations. You know, at the time of 9/11, it was assessed that Al-Qaeda had 3,000 fighters. Now they have somewhere between, and this is part of a worldwide franchise network, but they now have somewhere between 30 and 40,000. So we forget, you know, we don't talk about Al-Qaeda as much anymore, but they're still there. And they're important, and they're not going away. So, you know, this was a problem before the Islamic State. It'll be a problem after the Islamic State.
Do we have more headlines?
Yeah, we have, you know, we're speaking about, that was an RCMP case. Speaking of which, we have a new RCMP commissioner.
Right.
We have first female commissioner. She's put into this role. And I think it's important because she has experience working with Indigenous communities.
Right.
As well as, you know, they have a challenging issue with regards to their culture.
30-year veteran Brenda Lukey, promoted up through the ranks, coming out of the depot, the RCMP training facility in Saskatchewan. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. It's gonna be a very unique and possibly very difficult time for the RCMP. On top of the matters that we've been reading about in the newspaper in terms of the harassment issues that have arisen in the force, relations with communities broadly across the country, problems with contract policing. And I would say that the Globe and Mail ran a very interesting story about a week ago, as we record this, on contract policing and some of the challenges in that area in terms of understaffing by police officers in the municipalities that are policed on a contract basis. But coming forward, of course, is the RCMP is now unionizing. And so you will have members of the force who are in a position to exert considerable influence in a way that they haven't in the past. And what will that mean in terms of the dynamic within the force and more generally in terms of relationship between police and civil authorities?
Right. And I think, you know, and all of this is happening in the context which there's new oversight mechanisms for that the RCMP is going to be subject to, including the National Security Intelligence Committee of Parliamentarians, which we'll talk about later. But I mean, I can't imagine taking on that role. There's just so much going on. The RCMP is responsible from everything from local policing in Saskatchewan through to our most serious terrorism investigations.
Right.
They have so much responsibility and so many kind of issues to work out. So I wish her the best of luck.
Yeah. And she'll need a lot of support.
Last issue, just quickly, the Toronto Star finally, I think they did an access to information. They have confirmed that the police are using IMSI catchers. And I think this is...
I'm shocked to find their IMSI catchers being used in this police force.
Yes. Yeah, so, you know, good for them for finding out. I don't really understand why you would lie about this, because it's gonna get out somehow. It's just when you lie about these kinds of means and methods, I mean, if you don't want to comment on your means and methods, that's one thing. If you're going to directly say we don't do it and then we find out that you do, it just undermines confidence and trust, and I think that's a really bad thing.
I missed that. So they actually did lie,
according to the you know, the journalists involved. Hmm. Doing the study, that they actually did say that. So
yeah,
it's not like they're using them every day. They use them in 5 investigations, but still, it's like, why would you deny the use of the, it just boggles, you know, you're gonna get caught.
Well, I mean, when it comes to court, at some point this is likely to be subject to disclosure, and so if you've not kept a clean record in terms of being transparent in the use of this technology, then you might run into trouble. So yeah, the whole scenario, the whole IMSI story, I find very puzzling. This has been these things have been on the market, on the commercial market, for some time, and so I can't imagine that most people who are paying attention would assume that the law enforcement authorities did not have access to this technology. And so the sensitivity over this, again, I'm not close enough to this issue, but it always has struck me as disproportionate. And I stand to be corrected, and people can correct us on Twitter and elsewhere if we've led our listeners astray.
Okay, well, there you go. There's four raging headlines. I'm sure there'll be more soon. But we're on the budget. It's interesting. So if you're following along at home, playing the read-along game, it's basically we're looking at pages 203 through to 208 of the budget, where it basically outlines all of the new funding that's going to be put towards basically the security services. But the most important thing, and I think the one we saw the headlines about, and we mentioned briefly in one of the podcasts we've done, is that there's going to be funding for a cybersecurity strategy. And this is really kind of broken up into three kind of elements. The first one is a Canadian Center for Cybersecurity, which sounds like it's going to be modeled on the GCHQ system.
Remind us, GCHQ is the UK right. equivalent of Communication Security Establishment.
Yeah, so it's like their Signals Intelligence Agency. And what they do is they have kind of an outward-facing group that helps bolster cybersecurity within the UK, right? So it's kind of a one-stop shop where people can go for help, advice, whether you're in the government or in the private sector. So it's in the center in the UK is called the UK National Cybersecurity Center. In this case, the center is the Canadian Center for Cybersecurity. And again, it's about consolidating expertise. So there's all these kinds of different agencies. The one that kind of sticks out in my mind is Canadian Cyber Incident Response Center. And so they're going to basically bring all of those together. So I think we are going to see some shifting of resources. So, you know, what's going to be interesting to see is if like the CCIRC ends up under CSE, as well as other resources as well. And basically the budget actually specifies that there's going to have to be some legislation in order to do that. I'm not sure if they're talking about the budget legislation or if there's going to have to be some kind of legislation passed when they eventually do introduce the new cybersecurity strategy. But
yes, please don't put it in the budget. Please, we need to move away from the idea of putting substantive provisions into the budget legislation.
Like America style?
Or like the prior government.
Okay.
It's not a useful way of deliberative democracy.
Right. Okay, so that's element one. The second element here is that the RCMP will continue to have the criminal lead. So for cyber crimes, they will be doing the prosecution. So they're going to be getting a national cyber crime coordination unit. So they'll still look at things like all the kind of criminal activity that can happen online. And they will be the ones, whereas, you know, the Canadian Center for Cybersecurity will be in the business of mitigation. The National Cyber Crime Coordination Unit will be in charge of actually trying to prosecute. So I guess we'll have to kind of coordinate there too, because if you're disrupting the thing, I wonder if you're going to have an intel evidence thing there too, because you're trying to disrupt the thing that you're prosecuting. That could go kind of funny. That's going to be an interesting issue to watch. And finally, there's also funding for a National Cybersecurity Strategy. There's a lot of acronyms here. And this is housed in Public Safety Canada, as far as I'm aware, and it's going to be a kind of policy shop to provide small and medium enterprises guidance and tools. It's going to be a more, again, coordinated response. So those are kind of the three elements, and they actually outlined, I think there's more here than meets the eye. I think people were kind of more interested in the parental leave aspects of the budget, but they actually did give away quite a bit in the case, they said that they've outlined their three goals of cybersecurity, which we can expect to see in the strategy. So the first is a secure and resilient Canadian systems. So not government systems, Canadian systems. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about both public and private. A cyber ecosystem, which is really interesting. And for what it's worth, I did actually have a chance to talk to some D&D people about this. And they said, what's a cyber ecosystem? And they said, well, we're taking the language of innovation. And it's with a view to creating partnerships between businesses in the academy, bringing students in and training up students so that we actually have the people and the capabilities that are necessary in order to promote resilience and to promote cybersecurity. And finally, multinational partnerships. That's the third element. So there's going to be an international dimension to this as well, whether it's just working with allies or pushing for some kind of cyber diplomacy. It's not entirely clear yet, but there's a lot in there about our cybersecurity strategy.
Yeah. And of course, one of the issues that came out in the aftermath of the budget was whether the numbers are big enough. That is, whether the money's allocated for cyber will actually be able to accomplish the objectives set out. Some people were thinking as much as $1 billion would be allocated. It's not quite there. It's closer to, well, what, about half of that, I think, if you do
the... It's about half of that over 5 years,
over 5 years. The other aspect, of course, is so much of this is going to involve matters that, strictly speaking, are within provincial jurisdiction. And so to what extent is this going to engage the provinces on top of the private sector? So it's a, you know, cyber is one of these things. And I think about this all the time because I think about, well, you know, we really should teach a course on cybersecurity, cybersecurity law. And of course, the thing is it cross cuts in so many different areas.
Oh, yeah.
And so it's difficult to conceptualize it as a bundled unit, both for pedagogical purposes, but also in terms of public policy.
Right. Because it's a vector,
so many,
right?
It's so many actors.
Yeah.
And it's like we're going to work on traffic safety, but, you know, we have everything from the safety of the tires that you drive on through to the way you manage your highways. And so there's a whole bunch of different players that are implicated.
Yeah, no, I think that's about right. And I think, you know, like every single threat we talk about can also occur pretty much in cyberspace.
Right. And and not just in terms of the hacking and the espionage and technology transfer through illicit means, but also the use of cyber means in terms of disinformation, which we've talked about in the past. That's a discrete issue. It's the content that's problematic, using a means in a way that the means are supposed to be used for, that is to communicate.
Right.
And so these are all quite discrete issues. And I suppose maybe we should also mention, just in terms of our headlines here, that we missed one, which was that I saw an indication in the press that the government is going to look at the Canada Elections Act in terms of seeing whether it needs to be honed for purposes of disinformation and manipulation of elections in the wake of the 2016.
Third-party financing,
things we've talked about in the past. We're going to have to come back to that, obviously, but it'd be nice to have a little bit of better sense as to what they're planning to do before we do that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't always agree with Senator Frum, but she's been a leader on this issue, and I think that's a good thing. But just before we go there, I mean, there's the $500 million, but then it also seems that there's, if you look on page 206, there's a whole section on just infrastructure. And just building the infrastructure and some of the security challenges. Mm. And I think what, you know, they're talking about, you know, how can we better protect the government systems and both the front systems and the back systems. And one of the things, you know, that we could point to here is, I don't know if everyone remembers Heartbleed, which was an exploit that you could use to get the information from the CRA website and all the, you know, all the personal data that had been potentially compromised. So, you know, I think it's not just these cybersecurity centers. It's also the having secure digital services for Canadians. That's important. And finally, the CSE gets a good chunk of financing, too. They get $225 million over, I believe, again, 5 years in order to keep up with technological change.
Right.
And that's extra. Right. From their normal budget. So they're doing stuff. So there was actually quite a bit of security. The other thing I would point to is...
sanctions?
Sanctions, that was interesting.
Yeah, I thought that
they're getting so
too.
Much money for sanctions.
Well, it's not much money.
You don't think so?
$22 million over 5 years to hone up our sanctions system.
What would that involve?
Well, you know, so one of the issues with sanctions law is that we're an open economy, right? Mm-hmm. So all sorts of goods move through our economy, through the trading system. It's reasonably easy, it seems to me, to circumvent some of our sanctions through cutouts in third countries, which has been one of the issues in the past. Our sanctions law is not as broad as the U.S. law, and so it doesn't have a truly extraterritorial reach. When we do try to prosecute cases that involve overseas conduct, it's incredibly expensive. And so we've had these war crimes trials, for instance, were $5 million each.
Oh, right.
And so when you start talking about $22 million over 5 years and you think that's going to somehow bolster in a meaningful way your enforcement regime, I'm not saying it's nothing, but I don't necessarily think it's all of a sudden we're going to see a qualitative shift in the way that our sanctions regime has worked. And I may be wrong about that, but at least it's a step in the right direction. Can I mention just one other thing on the cyber front?
Right? Sure,
so it's not related to the budget, but something that came out I saw some coverage, a senior official in the FBI. It's the closest thing I've seen to a solution to the going dark problem. And so one of the issues for cybersecurity, and presumably one of the reasons why CSE needs more money, is because of the proliferation of encryption. And the consequences in terms of then trying to determine the content of communications that are encrypted in terms of computing power and what you have to invest in terms of cracking the encryption. And so that issue for a long time has been, well, do we need legislative or legal fixes that ease the prospect that with warrant or in circumstances where it's lawful to do so, the security services can have access to the content? And the conversation, as many of our listeners know, because we've talked about this in the past, and it's also been out there in discussions for lawful access, has been, well, there's two solutions. You can either build in back doors that would enable the security services to access the communications, which is problematic because you're building in a weakness into the communications infrastructure that both the good guys and bad guys could use, right?
Yeah.
And the other prospect is compelled decryption, where you have to cough up your decryption key, which is useless if you want to remain covert, and secondly also raises issues of self-incrimination and compelled speech. And so there's a third possibility that I hadn't thought of, which was raised by this FBI official, which is the idea of a third-party trustee who holds the decryption code in a vault, in a secure facility. So it's not in the hands of the, it's not a weakness in the sense that you're building in something that the government can use unilaterally, nor are you necessarily compelling the person who has encrypted the material to cooperate against their will with the authorities, but rather with warrant, the police could go to the third party and obtain the security services could go to the third party and obtain the decryption tool. Now, of course, there's issues there as well. You want to make sure that this third party is reliable, right? Because you can imagine the consequences of hacking the third party. But it's an interesting approach. It's the idea of offshoring in the hands of a third party the key to access the communication, so it's not in the hands of the government or within the monopoly control of the person that you may wish to survey. I had not thought of that, and it's kind of an interesting approach, and it'd be interesting to see if anyone takes that anywhere and what it would look like in practice.
Wait, I think it's preferable to having either the former two options. Certainly we know the forced backdoors and the decryption have been on the agenda of the five country ministerials, which of course is the Five Eyes countries get together and talk about security issues. And that's something that we know that, for example, the Brits in particular have been trying to bring forward, and we think the Americans are sympathetic to it too. So it'd be interesting to see if they do go for something like that. I still think, you know, one, Silicon Valley, not the hallmark of good ethical practices all the time. So I think we'd have to be really careful as to how these companies actually do that.
Yeah.
And I think privacy advocates would, again, also pretty much be up in arms at anything
like this. Well, that's an issue, right? So, you know, at the end of the day, privacy is, and I've said this before in this podcast, is the least absolute right in the human rights world, right? And it's least absolute on the face of the charter because it's reasonable. It's a reasonable expectation of privacy. And it's unreasonable searches and seizures that are barred by the charter. And so from the beginning of time, from the early origins of this right in the common law, there has been the capacity on the part of the state to interfere with that privacy. The issue has always been a procedural one. In what circumstance can they? And of course, the gold standard has been pre-authorization by an independent judicial officer on reasonable and probable grounds. The prospect now going forward is that even with that pre-authorization by an independent judicial officer on reasonable probable grounds, you will not have access to communications. And so to that degree, it's a feast and famine thing. It's a famine for the security services and the police to the extent that encryption becomes widespread and it becomes essentially impossible to access this. The fear on the part of privacy advocates is it's also a feast for the security services because they can use big data and they can compile things and paint portraits. And so both those things can be true at the same time.
But this is where something like an intelligence commissioner comes in.
Well, possibly, at least for CSE, but to superimpose this idea of an independent judicial officer. But again, the independent judicial officer can say lawfully you're entitled to intercept this, but practically you can't because of encryption. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? And so a lot of privacy advocates take a much more absolutist view of privacy, more absolutist than has ever been true in the common law tradition. Even with judicial authorization, your communications are sacrosanct, and so the proliferation of encryption is generally a good thing because we don't trust the state. Well, I mean, the state has a night watchman role, and so to the extent that the state is charged with protecting people, it needs information to do so. And so how do you find that balance? And it seems to me that the balance we've traditionally taken has been, again, the idea of an independent third party overseeing the actions of the state to ensure that it complies with proportionality and reasonableness in the exercise of these invasive surveillance powers. That legal fix is unworkable in circumstances where technology makes it moot. And so I think we do need to find a solution to the going dark problem. And we also have to make sure that our legal infrastructure is robust enough that legal check and balance on the state is in fact meaningful, right? And so it's a lot of work to be done on both sides. But to say, no, we can't, you know, we can't touch lawful access. It's just the way we have to live our lives these days and the states are going to be blind. I think that's dangerous. I think it's more extreme than has been the pattern in the past.
Okay, you heard it here, folks. Craig wants to hack into your junk.
Yeah, well, but it's I guess it's like everything else in this area. I think there is such a thing as balance.
And yeah, I mean, well, we agreed there is such a thing as a reasonable search, right? Like there is such a thing as a reasonable search. That's like one of the foundational ideas of prosecution, that you can reasonably search. There's unreasonable search, but there's reasonable right. search. And why this wouldn't apply to the digital world doesn't necessarily
make sense. In terms of the idea of the state being capable of using big data, piecing together all these innocuous pieces of information and painting this portrait that's deeply invasive, I think that is a real issue.
Yeah.
And so that's why
some countries more than others, but
well, I think it's also important to note that, for example, in the C59 context, as we've talked about before, the idea that CSIS will ingest information, a broader array of information, is subject thereafter in terms of retention to oversight by the federal court. And I think that is a step in the direction of sort of a 21st century understanding of privacy protection, which says it's not just the collection that matters. We've usually focused on gatekeeping at the collection level. It's not just the collection that matters. It's the subsequent retention and use that has to be policed because of the big data implications. And so I think we can accomplish both these things with adequate renovation of our law. And the point I'm trying to make is that the idea of trying to find a solution to the going dark, if it's polarized between you need a back door or you need compelled decryption, that's not going to work. Either of those solutions is unworkable. And so I find attractive the idea of this third option, which seems to me potentially an interesting thing to explore. All right, shall we move on? What else did you notice in the budget?
Right. So two other things. We have the CBSA, which is given $85 million and also will have an additional $173 for the Canada-US operations. I think there's been a lot of concern about people coming from Trump's America to Canada over the last couple of years, and I think politicians have unfortunately been exploiting those fears. But it's good that, you know, we need to treat these people humanely when they come across. They have to be given a fair trial. Most of them are sent back. But we can't just, you know, leave them on the streets when they're here. So they need to have those kinds of operations. The second thing is something we've talked about before are the no-fly kids.
Yeah, this is a big one.
Yeah, this is really important. There's 81.4 million over 5 years to develop a, quote, rigorous centralized screening model.
Yeah.
But this will be central. The key word here is centralized,
yeah,
because right now there is no centralized screening model, right? There's nothing to, when you're checked against a list, it's really the airlines doing it against a list that's provided. And we don't know what the airlines do with that list. Mm-hmm. And we don't know how good they are at doing that. And I said it before, I'll say it again. I don't trust Air Canada with my luggage.
Right.
I'm not sure I really like them to focus on terrorism.
Well, but it opens the door also to a redress system, right? So this is a response to the false positives issue.
Yes.
Which is if you're outsourcing your list to a bunch of airlines, it's very difficult to administer a recourse number that then will allow you to indicate squarely, I am not, you know, the John Smith that's on the list. I'm some other John Smith. And so the idea of a centrally administered list is a prerequisite to a successful recourse system. And the stumbling block hasn't been acceptance of that. The government's accepted that from day one, as far as I can tell. It's really been that it's going to be enormously expensive to put together, for reasons, frankly, I still don't understand, enormously expensive to put together a centralized list that would work in this manner. And so to its credit, to the government's credit, and also, frankly, to the enormous credit to the many families who came together and formed No Fly Kids and ran, I think, a pitch perfect advocacy campaign with obviously a very credible story to persuade the government that this should be a priority in circumstances where that's a fair amount of money.
That's true. But I think one of the good stories here is that we really have a bipartisan consensus, right? There's no political party who's sticking their hand up saying, no, this system we have is awesome. Yeah. Everyone agrees that this has to be fixed. $81.4 million, it is a lot of money, but at the same time, it's not a lot of money. It's, you know, it really depends on how you look at it.
Yeah, I just hope it doesn't, you know, it doesn't suffer the fate of Phoenix.
Well, I was going to say that's my big concern. The money's going to go to Public Safety, Transport Canada, and CBSA. But yeah, I mean, it's the Phoenix nightmare all over again. But hopefully we've learned some lessons from that.
Right. So our last topic today, Stephanie, because we're running out of time, we wanted to talk a little bit about, well, I don't want to talk about it, but I fear that we have
Twitter
to.
Twitter fighting.
L'affaire Atwal, right? So this is the aftermath, the aftermath of the Prime Minister's visit to India, which wouldn't generally implicate national security. I still don't think it implicates national security, but in part because there was apparently a briefing by the National Security and Intelligence Advisor on how it is that Mr. Atwal ended up in the reception in India, somehow has taken on its national security glean. And I don't want to get into the basics there. And I don't really want to tell this story because it's all over the media and people can Google it and find out what's going on and who's saying what. I think the issue that falls within our remit is the prospect that an inquiry into what exactly happened and how this individual ended up at the reception is properly the fodder of the National Security and Intelligence Committee of Parliamentarians.
Right.
It might implicate classified information.
Right. So we don't necessarily talk about what happened specifically in this case, but whether or not...
Because we don't have particular insight, right?
Well, no, we weren't there. We don't have access to the intelligence. We weren't at the briefings. I don't entirely understand how all these journalists suddenly have access to information that would let them declare intelligence true or not true, but that's beyond me. But so let's talk hypothetically about whether or not the National Security Intelligence Committee of Parliamentarians should take on a hot-button political issue.
Yeah, and in fact, to a certain extent, this issue is raised because during questioning over the budgetary aspects of national security, Minister Goodell suggested when asked about this affair that it first of all, it wasn't squarely within his portfolio, but also that there was a special committee that was charged with dealing with matters that it might implicate classified information. And so that door was opened, at least a crack, and thereafter you saw some media speculation as to whether the National Security and Intelligence Committee of Parliamentarians would take this on board, and they would neither confirm nor deny. The committee would neither confirm nor deny that this would be on their agenda, right? So it's not just entirely hypothetical here.
Okay, right. So let me make my case. So my view is that I think back to Dick Fadden, who was the director of CSIS. And very controversially, Dick Fadden, right before, and this is, I believe, in 2010, right before Dick Fadden, the visit of a Chinese leader came to Canada, he basically said on camera that there was foreign influenced activity from China against several political figures in Canada.
Yeah, albeit the first allusion to that, as I understand it, was at an event that was supposed to be quasi-private, but... Yeah.
It leaked out then too?
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So maybe he was asked, that's why he was asked the question. And then, so he said this information and it created a huge firestorm. I mean, now to say that there's Chinese foreign influence in Canada is kind of like, you know, might be page 8 of the Globe and Mail. But I mean, frankly, this was a huge story and it really, you know, damaged Fadden's reputation in a lot of circles. And what ended up happening was he was hauled in front of a committee and to testify about his remarks. And he said, look, I can't really go into the details here because it's classified. And so he couldn't defend himself from the questions. And in the end, you know, there's a number of people that were interviewed about, and the committee specifically wrote a report naming Dick Fadden in the title of the report. And they basically called him, like, they don't use the term racist, but they said that he'd hurt and gravely wounded Chinese Canadians, that he'd hurt Canada's international reputation, all these kinds of things. And it, you know, like nowadays, if someone said, okay, well, there's clandestine foreign influence from China in Canada, we'd go, yeah. You know, it's kind of nonsensical, but like he was really dragged over the coals for this. He couldn't defend himself. And if anything, I think a bunch of parliamentarians really just made themselves look stupid. And it wasn't a good use of their time. It wasn't a good use of his time. And the service ended up looking bad, too. So this is what I'm worried about is like, you know, we see senators and we see members of parliament demanding that Danielle Jean, who's a National Security Intelligence Advisor, now speak in front of a open parliamentary committee. He won't be able to defend himself again. And basically, it's just unfair. Right. He's gonna have to fight. He's not fighting with one hand tied behind his back. He's fighting with two hands tied behind his back. So it's like, I'm thinking, okay, if there is a legitimate concern about either Sikh extremism in Canada or the activities of the Indian intelligence services in Canada, the proper forum for this is the National Security Intelligence Committee of Parliamentarians. That's where these issues can be addressed, and they can mention it in their report to Canadians that, yes, we looked into this interview, and maybe we disagree, or we're not going to comment on the appropriateness of the National Security Intelligence Advisor in terms of what he did, but we looked into this issue when we found such, such, such.
Yeah.
So I think that's why I feel that this is the appropriate forum, because it's, you know, it's a political issue in what is theoretically supposed to be a depoliticized forum, where they can actually ask and get proper answers to the questions.
Right. Well, I mean, I understand that, and I'm sympathetic to that view, to the extent that there's a real issue here, right? And so if the issue is, where can we have an intelligent, mature conversation about foreign influenced activity? I agree with you. I think that has to be in a classified setting, and no better venue, it seems to me, than the National Security and Intelligence Committee of Parliamentarians. My concern here isn't so much about foreign influenced activity, though. It's about whether this is just one giant big nothing burger, right? And so it is entirely possible that the series of events that took place in India are a diplomatic embarrassment, and perhaps there was some truth to the idea that the Indians were gaming this in some manner, and so it's diplomatically not a great thing. Still don't see it as a national security issue, certainly in terms of priorities, not high on the priority list. So that's the first point. Second point, even if I accepted at face value that this is a fairly important national security issue, that what happened in India in terms of this reception does raise national security issues, I think I'd require some persuading of that. But even if I accepted that, the issue is whether the Committee of Parliamentarians is currently endowed with the culture and capacity and resourcing that this should be an issue on their agenda. So let me suggest that that's not the case. First point, this is a committee that's brand new, whose culture is not gelled. As best we know, it has not yet undertook any studies of any sort. And so if it were to undertake this study, it would be one of the first studies, if not the first study, that it would undertake. So right away, we're asking it to develop its modus operandi on a topic, and this is my second point, that is entirely designed to cause the committee to divide on partisan lines. Because the government MPs will have a strong incentive to exonerate the conduct of the government, and in part because of the notoriety of this case and the extent to which at least the polling data suggests that it's stuck with Canadians, the opposition parties will have a strong incentive to keep it alive, percolating, bubbling along. And so right away, this committee is asked to undertake an activity that enhances partisan divide rather than overcomes it. And that seems to me to be an invitation for absolute train wreck disaster. And in part, that's illustrated by what's happened with the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence of the United States, where,
right,
which has a much longer established tradition and yet has foundered over on partisan lines over the issue of Russian influence in the 2016 election, and has fractured in a way that undermines the credibility not just of congressional figures, but has tarred the intelligence services. And so the risk is that the intelligence services will be dragged into a partisan bun fight on matters that are in some large degree not important, at least as compared to the more generic issues about foreign influenced activities. Are we adequately protected as a society for the next election? Intelligence to evidence, have we got it right? Do our intelligence services have the right priorities? How are we going to deal with cyber? All these big picture issues, which frankly, if we get wrong, people get really hurt. And I don't know that this matter coming out of India, the L'Affaire Etoile, while of course it's tied to the tragic history of Air India, I'm not sure that I would put it on the first rank of issues that should be inquired, frankly, either by the National Security Committee of Parliamentarians or even by a regular parliamentary committee. And I certainly worry that if it were, that the National Security Committee of Parliamentarians would break before it's even underway.
So I think you raised very legitimate points. I would challenge you on a couple of things. One, I think the difference between NSI COP and the House Intelligence Oversight Body is that
in the U.S.
Is that it's in the U.S. it's far more public, right? It's become a far more public body, with testimony being released and all these other things. So I think there's a little bit of a difference there, that it's always been a little bit more public as a result. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that the MPs that were selected for this committee are ones that have been around for a while, right? There's no there's no one on that committee, as far as I'm aware, that's kind of green. There's no one there really gunning for cabinet positions. There's no one's really there gunning for leadership positions. So I think they may be able to handle it with a little bit more maturity. I agree. It's fragile at this time.
Yeah.
We don't know how this is going to work. And I agree with you that this isn't the best or most ideal issue. But like, I would rather see, like, if we have to have some kind of inquiry, I would rather...
Which I don't think we do.
Which, fair. Totally okay. Fair. But while people are kind of calling for blood, I would rather see it go to NSICOP yeah. than a parliamentary
body. I take your point that the MPs could rise above this.
But will they? We don't know.
Will they?
And it's a risk.
But it's still an expenditure of resources and time.
Yes.
Right? And so again, there are really pressing issues. And so the concern I've always had about NSICOP is that it will chase those dangling baubles that are in the headlines and go down those rabbit holes and disappear down those rabbit holes and never deal with the really hard structural issues that no one is looking at.
Yeah.
Right. And so if they chase the baubles, yeah. I'd rather spend the money elsewhere.
I mean, is the solution to have parliamentary bodies that can hear things in camera or to hear things?
Well, they can. They can hear things in camera, but that doesn't mean necessarily they're going to have access to classified information.
Yeah, I just think that maybe then, I hate to say it, like, is there a hole here?
Well, I think this whole case was a problem. Sending out the National Security and Intelligence Advisor to do a briefing with the media, the parliamentarians were sure to turn around and say, okay, give us the same briefing, right? So, I think this is a one-off that is best looked at as, boy, geez, there's a lot of issues here that probably should have been handled better. Do we really want to keep this alive and spinning? And is there a reason to keep it alive and spinning that's got anything to do with bona fide national security concerns that not about partisan gain?
But that's shit we don't know. Mm. We don't know. And like I said, if this has to be looked at, I think it should go to NSI. I would rather go to NSICOP than parliamentary. That's okay. What I'm saying. But I think we both agree that this just a whole affair is... I think it's been colored by people who seem to have determined that they know what the intelligence is better than the actual intelligence services. I have so many media friends who complain to me all the time that they don't have access to sources in the intelligence community. Like, wow, it's not like the US, they don't have access. And the second they get a briefing, the first thing they do is out the guy and then doubt everything he said.
Yeah.
And they're like, well, we determined he was lying, so we outed him. And I'm like, okay, well, congratulations. You're never going to get this again.
Yeah.
So
I don't know the sequence of events well enough.
So let's talk about it more. So it's look, I think, I don't know. I do see what you're saying with NSICOP. I very much respect what you're saying with NSICOP, but like, I would rather, I don't want, having seen what Fadden went through, the absolutely, in retrospect, embarrassing report that the House, our House of Commons wrote, is just, a good example of why we don't have these officials go in front of them on delicate national security questions. Is this a delicate national security question? I don't know. I think we both agree it's a political one. Yeah.
And on that happy note, we're out of time.
See you next time.
Bye-bye, everyone.